Jenna Robinson, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been on hold before on the phone?
Yes, it's maddening.
It is a terrible experience in general. It would be like you're waiting for your trial to begin or something like that, and you're just seething with rage, and you want to just blow everything up. Well, fortunately, a lot of people feel the way you do when you're on hold, and there's a company that's here to solve your problems. It's called TextLine. TextLine is a web-based software that lets you and your customers exchange text messages. So if you're a business, you sign up at textline.com. You'll get a new business phone number in your local area code that your customers can use to text you and your team. TextLine offers a 30-day free trial, but you can get a bonus free month if you sign up at textline.com/castofkings. That's textline.com/castofkings. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I haven't read most of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, find more episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. You can also comment on this podcast episode at facebook.com/acastofkings. What we do here on this podcast, we recap every episode of Game of Thrones, and that means that we'll spoil this week's episode. That's Season 6, Episode 10, The Winds of Winter. And it means we won't spoil anything from future week's episodes or from the books that hasn't been shown in the show already. So that's what we do here on this podcast. And wow, Joanna, it was a crazy season finale. And it has been a pretty crazy season overall. Lot of interesting developments. I feel like season finales have typically been a big come down from the, you know, usually action-packed season nine. Episode nine. And this episode really was an exception to that, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I think, spoiler alert, guys, I loved the episode. I think this is their best season finale they've ever done.
I think
like,
so, too.
Hands down,
and,
yeah.
And for many people, I read a lot of writing saying that this is probably one of many writers' favorite episode of the series thus far. Would you go that far, Joanna? Was this your favorite episode of the series thus far?
No, but I think it was the best first 20 minutes of any episode.
Yeah, I think we can definitely agree to that. Well, let's dive right in by talking about that first 20 minutes, Joanna, because there is so much to unpack here. So I want to say before we start today that we loved this episode of the show. and I'm speaking for both of us because I'm pretty sure Joanna is a big fan as well. And I was an enormous fan, and my mouth was agape during many portions of the episode. I was shocked. I was excited. I was stunned. I cried at one point. I was very moved by it. And so I went on the whole roller coaster of emotions. This lived up to everything I could have ever wanted and hoped for in the season finale. So I want to start by saying that because I think a lot of people, when they listen to this podcast, they hear only the negative things, and they don't hear the positive things. They just want to geek out about the episode. But, you know, I did have some beefs with the episode, and we'll talk about those as well. But I just wanted to start by making sure it's clearly understood that I was an enormous fan of this episode, and I thought it's just, you know, one of the best things I've ever seen on TV. So start with that. All right. I've thrown that down.
I will say, for external, like, enjoyment of fiction reasons, I was, like, emotionally invested in liking this episode because, you know, I think it's true that we all just have a better week if Dave and Joanna liked the episode. And so as we were, like, counting down the episode, I was sitting there, like, full of dread. I was like, please don't hate this episode, Joanna. Please don't hate it. And then it started in the, you know, in the, like, great score and just looked different from a lot of episodes of Game of Thrones, just really stylish, really interesting. And I was like, oh, I was like just flooded with relief and elation. Then I was like, oh, I'm going to like this. I'm so excited. So
yeah. I just want to say one last thing about that element of us watching the show and doing the podcast before we move on, which is the thing that is dismaying that I see about online fan culture is there is this kind of demand for consensus. Do you know what I mean? That, hey, everyone liked this episode. I like this episode, so like I'm like everyone in that I like this episode. And if you didn't like it, well, something must be wrong with your opinion, or something's wrong with my opinion, and I know something's not wrong with my opinion. And so this kind of fan culture demands that everyone agree for some reason. Like, it's not okay to disagree with what everyone else thinks, or else it somehow invalidates your opinion. And I'll say, you know, 5-10 years ago, I probably thought like this. You know, I probably had those feelings when, like, I really love something, and then I saw someone online say or write that they didn't like it, and it felt very invalidating, you know? And so I can completely relate with that feeling. But I guess I'll just say that I'm in a phase of my life now, and I'm not saying it's more advanced phase or anything. It's just like, as you get older, you start to give less fucks about whether or not everyone has the same opinion on something. And I'm more interested in, if someone didn't like it, can they convince me that, you know, it wasn't that good? Or why did they not like it? Like, what about their life experience makes it not as enjoyable for them? And that's kind of what I'm more interested in these days. But so I kind of wish that, you know, more people would be like that and wonder about differences in opinion and try to explore them. But it doesn't feel like the preeminent point of view online right now when it comes to these sorts of things. Nonetheless, wanted to say there has been a bunch of listeners that have tweeted and emailed in support of the show and saying they really enjoy what we do here on the podcast. And so we're really grateful to all of you who are listening today, because I assume if you are listening that you have some interest in what we're talking about. So
that you didn't rage quit last week because of what we said. What I want to say about that is I got a lot of tweets from people today. Shocker, really shocker that like they didn't like this episode and that they love Battle of the Bastards, but they hated this episode. And, you know, as you know, my opinion is the reverse. And I have no, I mean, so yay. I mean, let's have different opinions. That's all I think.
Let's have different opinions. All. And if you didn't like the episode, we want to hear about why. Like, I'm genuinely interested. So do email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We will have a bonus episode, part of which will be discussing your emails. So do email us there, again, at acastofkings@gmail.com. All right. So enough of the caveats, Joanna. Let's talk about this incredible opening, okay? The episode begins with a very funereal atmosphere. This kind of montage of close-ups, everyone getting ready. You realize, hey, the High Sparrow, he puts on his sack just like everyone else in the morning.
One armhole at a time.
one filthy armhole at a time.
Yeah.
And the score is quite different than it usually is. And in fact, the score hit Spotify last night, the season 6 score of Game of Thrones by Ramin Djawadi. And it is amazing. And he really branches out here. He uses a lot of piano, which he doesn't typically use in his score. And he also uses cello solo to great effect, which, you know, I'm a fan of. He does that also in the opening credits. Speaking of opening credits this week, was it just me or was there a Stark banner on Winterfell?
Yeah, the Direwolf is back on top of Winterfell.
So awesome to see. So,
bye-bye, Boltons. Yep. The track in question, I believe it's called The Light of the Seven. And yeah, you can stream it on Spotify right now or buy it if you want to support the show that way. But I listened to it a lot this morning.
Yeah.
Speaking of that opening of everyone getting ready, Miguel Sapochnik, the director who did last week's episode and Hard Home, and I genuinely very much admire, he said that he wanted to shoot it almost like a perfume commercial is what he said, like a lot of close-ups on like rings and necklaces and all, you know, just like this weird, like he just wanted to set an atmosphere of like everyone getting ready. And I just thought it was used to amazing effect. And I don't know if it, you know, the theory that Cersei was going to blow up the Sept using wildfire, I think, was telegraphed kind of heavily through, well, I don't know about heavily, was kind of telegraphed in the season. So a lot of people went into the episode suspecting that that was what was going to happen. But I think what they used really well is that old, it's Hitchcock's theory about like suspense versus surprise, right? Like knowing the bomb is under the table, it makes the scene almost better knowing that there's a bomb, right?
If two people are having a conversation and a bomb explodes, it's a surprise. But if two people are at a table talking and you see a bomb under the table and you see the clock ticking and you wonder what's going to happen, that is suspense. And this episode opted for suspense. Did it do so in a good way? I kind of want to talk to you about that in a bit,
okay.
Joanna.
All right.
So anyway, awesome opening. And some great close-ups and great photography and awesome costumes. I think Cersei's outfit this episode is top-notch. I know you've had beef with costumes this season, Joanna. What did you think of Cersei's outfit?
As someone pointed out to me that she looked like a Vulcan, and I both agree and think she looked amazing.
Yeah,
so,
she looked great. And I will just say that, as with many things we'll find out during the course of this episode of the podcast, I did not see that coming with regards to the wildfire. I remember, I think it was either last week or 2 weeks ago, Cersei says, hey, did you explore that rumor? Is there any truth to it? But I had no idea what was coming. And in fact, the...
No, and I think you asked me, and I think that I did that thing where I don't say the thing.
Yes, good job.
So that you can go into the world like an innocent child, Dave Chen.
I appreciate that, Joanna, so much. And the funereal atmosphere made me feel like it was Cersei that was going to her death. I was convinced that that was going to happen, that maybe she's going to pull out some last-second Trump card of some kind, but really that this was about how Cersei was going to die. But in fact, it was about everyone except Cersei dying. And so quite a shock. Anyway, there is the trial of Loras Tyrell, and he confesses, and in heartbreaking fashion, he renounces everything he's ever known or owned, and it is very sad to see that, and you see Marjorie see it too. And I think Natalie Dormer, who plays Marjorie Tyrell, or I guess now Baratheon, she delivers such an amazing performance, because her performance is not just, hey, you're holding back rage, it's you're pretending to be someone who is trying to put a happy face on everything and barely holding back rage. And there's just a lot of layers to that performance, I feel like, during the course of this whole sequence that I just thought was astonishing. But anyway, Loras Tyrell, has a trial, he's found guilty, and they carve up his forehead, Quentin Tarantino style, and Marjorie gets super upset because apparently her and the High Sparrow had some kind of agreement that he would not be mutilated. I guess my question at this point for you, Joanna, is when all this was going on, what did you think would happen? Did you already know that the wildfire thing would happen at this point? Like, you knew going into the episode that it was all...
Yes.
Gotcha. Interesting.
But it's funny because I thought it was going to be the end of the episode. You know, it's like such a huge thing that I thought they were going to end it. So when they start with everyone getting ready for the trial, I was like, oh my God, they're starting with wildfire?
How are they going to end this episode? So a few other things happen as well. We see Maester Pycelle, he's still up to his, I guess, prostitute-using ways, and he gets lured into Maester Qyburn's lair.
Laboratory?
His lab.
Yeah.
And then Lancel goes out looking for Cersei. And so is there a reason why Lancel follows this kid down into...
You know, there's a debate raging among our live listeners right now as to why Lancel followed that little bird, as they're called, down. I think he just looked suspicious. I don't know if that kid was sent to lure Lancel, but the kid looked a little fishy. And so Lancel, with his spidey senses tingling, I think, followed the kid down. But it was great because, you know, really you need it for story structure, right? You need a point of view, a character we know down there. It can't just be like... you know, a grubby little street kid. It needs to be someone we know, hopefully, down there with the wildfire.
It felt quite contrived to me.
Crawling towards the melting candle, which is a great, like, ye olde timey version of a fuse, right?
Yes, very well done. Very well done. But yeah, it felt to me like the things we complained about last week at the Battle of the Bastards, I felt like kind of applied to Lancel just randomly following this kid, spending all this time tracking this person down. He has no idea why this child might be important to, you know, he's been given a task to do, and he's just completely ignoring it. It just doesn't make any
sense. No, he sends two other sparrows. He's like, hey, you know.
You guys go on. I'll catch up with you, kind of
frickin'
thing.
Frickin' frack. You go get Cersei. I see a suspicious-looking street child, and I'm going to follow him.
I need to follow them into the depths of the Sept. Anyway, it felt like one very tiny misstep in an otherwise exceptional sequence, and I understand why they needed to do it. Because, as we discussed, you want the suspense. You don't want it to just be a surprise. You want to know, hey, is Lancel going to blow out this candle before everything ignites in a huge flame? So you get that, but, you know, it's a little bit weird. The setup is a little bit weird, in my opinion. Anyway, okay. He gets down there.
For me, I mean, honestly, I think part of what makes it work for me is that crazy music. Like, the whole atmosphere is so eerie.
Yeah.
And, like, people being lured and pieces being moved and Tommen being, like, held back in his room and all this sort of stuff. And it's just, like, and Margaery's rising panic. And it's just, like, this weird, almost supernatural atmosphere that I really do think the score helped underline. But
The intercutting between the scenes is also exceptional. Like,
yeah.
Just the way they built the tension by cutting between different locations, I thought was so good. And Margaery loses her composure, which I don't think we've ever seen her do in the history of the series, when she says something like, forget the bloody gods, and, you know, listen to me. And you realize, wow, she knows what's up. She's the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
And man, like, these guys better listen to her.
I don't mean to nitpick you, but I think we saw her lose her composure when, like, Loras got arrested, when, like, she got arrested. But, like, Margaery, you're so right that Margaery is the kind of person who rarely lets her mask slip. So when she does, like, so rarely, it's quite alarming.
Yeah.
And so to see her, who's, like, usually so political, panic, and as you say, be the smartest person in the room, have the best read on Cersei of anyone, really effective.
Agreed. And what I love about this whole sequence is that they make you feel the whole Loras storyline. I mean, the whole him confessing, getting his face carved in, and there's this moment when Margaery goes up to him and says, like, Loras, like, stay with me, and it is so powerful because she realizes, oh my gosh, we've been through so much. Just stay with me a little while longer. I'm going to get you through this. And Loras is at the end of such a long and arduous journey. And we all have felt parts of it, and it's been intense. And the show subjected us to all of that before just blowing it up, Joanna.
Mm-hmm.
That is audacious from a storytelling perspective. I mean, that takes balls. It takes guts. And I was in awe that the show accomplished this. So anyway, we're getting to the final moment when, you know, Margaery tries to leave. You see all the important people in the Sept, Kevin Lannister, Mace Tyrell, and a bunch of High Sparrow and his henchmen, as well as his followers. And they try to leave, and they're unable to. The High Sparrow insists that they will still have the trial even without Cersei. Margaery's like, hey, we have more important things to deal with right now. The wildfire ignites. It blows up everything. And the High Sparrow and the Tyrells share this look before they're all consumed in flames. And I love this moment because it really lays bare the High Sparrow's weakness, which is ultimately arrogance and hubris, right? That he thought that with God on his side, or with the gods on his side, that he could be judge, jury, and executioner, and that no one would dare defy him. And because of that hubris, they all perished. I mean, they probably all would have died anyway. You know, like, that explosion was pretty freaking big. But it's really the proximate cause of them dying, I think, was him thinking that he was above it all. So what did you make of this whole sequence overall? How did you react to it? Like, what was going through your mind?
I mean, it looked glorious, I think. I mean, it's the culmination of what I expected to happen. I thought it was very well done. I was thrilled by it. I love the part with the bell, which I consider like a callback to the whole like shame walk through the street situation. right? It, if you look at the shot, I wrote about this on Vanity Fair today, but if you look at the shot, it's the same place. I mean, she walked along a long street, but that bell hits exactly where the close-up of the nun going shame and ringing her bell happened. So, yeah, and I mean, and then Cersei watching it all smugly and sipping wine. Like, I don't know, man. Very satisfying to me. Like, Cersei's not a good person, but I'm still rooting for her in this situation as much as I love Marjorie, which I do. But, like, I guess my one disappointment is that Marjorie played the game better than almost anyone, and she still went down like a chump, you know? But that's just – you could be the best player and still not win. So that's the quirk of fate in Westeros. But
well, arguably, she also made a miscalculation when she went up against Cersei. You know, I mean, if she hadn't, maybe she would have lived somehow, right? Like, maybe Cersei wouldn't have put the High Sparrow onto her and her brother. So it's tough call. It's tough call. But I agree. You know, Cersei and Marjorie go up against each other in the Game of Thrones, maybe five wins for one, five wins for the other. Like, they're very closely matched, I would say. I'll tell you my reaction.
Yes.
When I was watching the High Sparrow get ignited in flames is for about maybe an eighth of a second, I thought maybe like it's just going to blow up that like low section of the Sept and everyone else is going to live and the High Sparrow will survive. But no, like literally the next shot, everyone is killed. Anyway, Cersei basically perpetrates King's Landing's 9/11. I think one of my disappointments of this episode is we didn't get to find out what was the aftermath of that act. Like, did everyone know that she killed everyone, or was it just an accident officially that this huge cache of wildfire got set aflame?
I feel like we're gonna see that shoe drop next season. Mm-hmm. or we won't. No, but I feel like there's no way we're not gonna see that shoe drop next season, and at least Jaime like knows, and that's going to have consequences. But the show has also just glossed over things like that. Like, for example, in Dorne, when Ilaria commits like a coordinated assassination of the rulers of Dorne, and then it's just the leader of Dorne, and it seems like it's fine, and there's no like ramifications for this bloody coup. So, but that's Dorne, where we don't want to probe too deep because we don't want to spend more time in Dorne. But like,
did your heart sink at the opening of the episode when Dorne was in the opening credits?
No, because, I mean, I know you guys hate it when I say I know things, but I knew Olenna was going to be there, and I was excited for that to be sassy, which it was. So, yeah.
Yeah, the other shoe might drop next season. More likely, I think there'll just be vague references to it that other characters make, like when Cersei blew up the Sept of Baelor or something like that.
Well, Nicola Costa-Waldau said in an interview that there's no way that anyone in King's Landing would be okay with Cersei being queen. And, like, I feel like the read on the audience shot, I mean, this is skipping ahead, but I feel like the read on the audience in that chamber when she's crowned is pretty ambiguous. Like, you're not seeing people, like, go like, rah, 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 rah. But, you know, maybe they're like, a little worried because she's a terrorist and now she's, got the throne. So,
yeah, I don't know. I don't think we know enough because maybe it was just an accident that the whole Sept got blown up.
Tricksy wildfire, man. It'll just go up sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You have no idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. A really fantastic shot in this episode as well was Tommen seeing this whole thing happen.
Yes.
And then the camera lingers on that windowsill for just a little too long. Like, you wonder, why is the camera still on this windowsill? And then Tommen gets on that windowsill and jumps off. Some questions in the chat room about why didn't Cersei go to Tommen? Any thoughts on why that was the case, I guess?
Well, Weiss and Benioff said, like, external show interviews are legit, right? Weiss and Benioff told Deadline today that Cersei was too focused on her revenge to take proper care of Tommen, and that's why he died. Like, her focus was on then punishing Septa Unella and having the mountain come down and help her with that, when the mountain should have been watching Tommen, or Cersei should have been with Tommen. So basically, like, she let her thirst for vengeance supersede what has been a driving force for her, which is, you know, taking care of her children, and she suffered the consequences of that.
Yeah.
You know, so I love that shot because, yeah, the camera doesn't move. Tommen leaves frame.
Yep.
And then comes back. It's a great shot. Really well done.
What is your assessment as to why Tommen kills himself?
I think knowing Margaery was in there and is dead.
Yeah.
And probably knowing that knowing for certain that his mother did it, mostly because her goon is the one who made him stay in his room.
Yeah.
So just sort of feeling like this helplessness, and also feeling the weight of his own responsibility in this, because he's the one who called the order last week to be like, no trial, but, you know, basically, you know, signed his mother's death sentence, or 2 weeks previous, his mother's death sentence. And that's what started her down this path of vengeance. And so his own, even though, like, I certainly don't blame Tommen, but, like, his own, you know, complicity in it, I think.
Yeah, I blame Tommen for all their deaths. So this suicide was quite satisfying for me. No, I'm just joking. It's a tragedy. It's very sad. And, yeah, I mean, Cersei is left with pretty much no one other than her brother at this point, right? So,
no, I mean, she's got the loving embrace of the mountain and Qyburn. What more family could you possibly want in this world?
On that note, any theories as to why she had Qyburn get stabbed, or I'm sorry, why Maester Pycelle got stabbed to death by those little birds versus I assume he would have been at the trial.
All I can say is he dies similarly in the books, so I don't know if they just wanted to do that. He dies, I think, via crossbow in the book. But
my guess was that she just wanted him to have a more...
like an extra special.
An extra special, because all those people in the Sept got a very quick death, you know?
Yeah.
And she wanted his to be much more painful and horrifying, is my guess. Speaking of painful and horrifying, the mountain... and what happens to Septa Unella?
Yeah.
So there's this great monologue about, you know, being able to confess that you like to do things, and that's okay if you like to do things. It's cool. Confessing can be cool. And then she's like, hey, you know, Septa Unella is like, oh, well, I'm ready to die. It's all good. And Cersei is stunned that Septa Unella would presume that she could die today. And then, you know, the mountain comes in, and what happens there, Joanna? What do you think goes on after that?
My assessment is based on when Oberyn fought the mountain, you'll remember.
Yep.
His, like, repeated refrain was, you raped her, you murdered her, killed her children, or whatever, talking about what the mountain did to his sister, Ilya Martell. I'm pretty sure that the mountain is raping Septa Unella, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is horrifying. And
But here's what I'll say. I mean, like, you know, we all know that I like to clamber on my soapbox about rape, but, like, at least in this instance, I think that the rape is just is there to be the most inhumane, depraved kind of torture, like, and that's as it should be. And the camera doesn't linger on it. You watch Cersei walk out of the room. So,
there's barely a hint of what is even happening, like, from a visual perspective.
Were it not for this, like, repeated slogan about the mountain and, you know, his tendency to rape and then murder, I think you could come up with a number of ideas for what he could be doing, but that would be my best guess.
Well, maybe he's a changed man after he came back to life, unlike Jon Snow. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I tweeted out last night, what are people's theories about what's going on there? And rape seems to be the consensus, which is really, really horrifying. I just saw The Neon Demon, which also has necrophilia in it, and it is really disgusting to consider and behold. But one of the things that I think is kind of interesting about this scene is that it brings to light one of the, I don't know if I could say, like, conflicts or tensions in religion, which is that the people who do the punishment or do the shaming can often derive a kind of sick pleasure from it. And I'm reminded of Kevin Spacey's words in Seven when, you know, Brad Pitt accuses him of enjoying doing those crimes. And Kevin Spacey says, you know, there's nothing wrong with a man taking pleasure in his work. But there is something really also depraved about that. And for that reason, I think we are meant to take some kind of perverse pleasure in watching Septu and Nella get punished. Right? What do you think? I think that's the prevailing reaction, is not, wow, that's horrifying. It's more, man, it's like, damn, Cersei got her revenge. Or probably maybe like between those two. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say between, because I was enjoying like the wine boarding, the waterboarding, but with wine,
yeah,
sort of scene. And Cersei's right that she's like, you know, what you were doing was not just your job. You took malicious delight in tormenting me. And I think that's an accurate assessment on Cersei's part. So the fact that she's tormenting this woman by pouring wine on her, you know.
Yeah, I was with her so far. You're waterboarding with the wine. That's cool.
Yeah, you know? That's a Cersei twist on a classic. And then, you know, if she had like murdered her right then, which is what Unella was like ready for, you know, that would have been that. But this added thing then is a, you know, yeah. I mean,
I don't take
any pleasure in that situation at all. No.
Right. No, fair enough. And that's what the show does. That's what Game of Thrones does, is it pushes you beyond the realm of what you're comfortable with, right? Like, if it had been those things, a conventional show would have done those things, probably, right? But this show says, hey, no, we're going to make Cersei's revenge a little bit disproportionate, and then let you decide, you know, what to believe about that. And it just makes you deeply uncomfortable. I did see a lot of rejoicing on Twitter and, you know, in articles about Unella's punishment, but I don't know. It went a little bit far. And I honestly think the vagueness of what was actually happening to her allowed for these emotions to take hold in a way that might not have happened if it was more graphic. But
I had heard a theory a couple weeks ago that the Mountain was going to beat her to death with her own bell. And that was almost like more poetic. Like, I didn't want to watch the whole thing, but like the dinging of the bell as it hit her would be like kind of, yeah. But like sexual assault from like an undead hulking monster. I mean, that lady sucked, but I can't get on board. You know, this is my line in the sand.
Yep, that's your line in the sand, is being forcibly raped by a dead person.
Yeah.
Well, Jonah, I don't know. Maybe you need to reconsider your priorities.
Okay.
But anyway, I think that's most of the King's Landing storyline, with the exception of one scene that you already mentioned, which is Cersei is crowned the Queen of Westeros in one of the last scenes of the episode. And Jaime has arrived home in time to see the smoldering husk of the Sept of Baelor, and then watches the coronation. And he is not joyful about it. He does not look happy. And I think part of that is probably that he knows what she had to do for that to happen. Part of that is that Tommen's dead. But there's all these pregnant looks between the two of them. And I was wondering what your read on that was.
Well, I think the seeds for this were planted, well, I would say back during the Bran and Jaime confrontation a couple episodes ago, but sort of him reaccessing the better parts of his nature and really brought home, you know, I don't want to get us off course, but in the conversation that he had with Walder Frey about, Walder Frey's like, we're both Kingslayers, we're the same, and we don't give a shit if what they say about us. And it's like so clear that Jaime does, and he doesn't want to be Walder Frey, any version of Walder Frey. Mm. And so when he returns home and he sees the depths that Cersei has sunk to in order to get her vengeance, and he just like does not want to be on Team Cersei anymore, is my reading of the whole situation. That he looks at her and he's like, I don't recognize that. That's not a team that I want to be on. And because I feel like if I go down this path, I'll become Walder Frey, and that's my worst nightmare. So no, thank you.
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting, especially considering I believe it was 2 weeks ago or last week that he threatened to catapult Edmure's baby over the battle line. So, yeah. But maybe he's just all talk, Joanna. You know, maybe he just doesn't, maybe he wouldn't really have done that. And he was saying all that stuff because he wanted to get back home to his one true love, this woman who just murdered all these people. So maybe that's part of it too, is that
to me, it felt like he was protesting a little too much. Like when he, I mean, I don't know if this is wishful thinking because I really like Bran and Jamie as scene partners, let alone romantic partners. But like, and I just think he's better when he's away from Cersei. We've talked about this, but I think when he has that scene with Bran and feels a connection to her and a connection to the better version of himself, which we saw in previous seasons. And then he's like, he sort of doubles down. It seems like he protests too much. I think when he's like, Cersei's my one true love and she's all I care about. And I will do the most vile, disgusting things to get back to her because that's who I am. But then he talks to Walder Frey and he's just like, I don't want to be this guy. That might be me laying too much on top of it, but it's sort of backed up by some book stuff. So I think that that's where we'll see Jamie go.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you in the sense that Jamie is not exactly like the most blameless person on the show. You know,
no.
He's done some pretty horrifying things right from the first episode where he pushed Bran out the window. Man, how far away we are from that now.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he's done some depraved, horrifying acts. And the idea that like anything could be too depraved for him, unless he's actually making a genuine character turn, I would agree with you that perhaps he doth protest too much.
Well, yeah. And then also there's the whole, like, the reason that he has to walk around with this shameful Kingslayer brand is that he did it to save the city from being blown up by wildfire, right?
Right.
And then his sister did exactly that. Did exactly the thing that he sacrificed his honor to protect the world from.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't see them having any kind of relationship going forward.
It almost makes you think, Joanna, that if Jaime and Cersei had the ability to text each other, that maybe they could have prevented a lot of these horrifying things from happening. You know what I mean?
I should say so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, texting would have been an awesome way for them to communicate while they're doing other things. Because they're busy people, you know? They can't just, like, place a phone call. Firstly, because that technology doesn't exist in Westeros. And secondly, because, hey, man, texting is a really convenient way of contacting people and asking them questions and maybe ordering something or issuing a command, which might have come in the form of something like, hey, don't kill thousands of people in your, you know, sick act of revenge. That probably would have helped.
Also, anyway. our son, the product of our incestuous love, protect him.
yes. Maybe check it on
him. If you're going to murder his bride, make sure you don't leave him unattended near giant open windows.
Yes.
Thanks. Kay, thanks, bye.
Yes, Kay, thanks, bye. Well, you know, fortunately, there is an awesome service that lets you send and receive texts, whether you're a regular person or a business. It's called textline.com. And a lot of businesses, they have landlines. They don't use personal smartphones to do their business. And, you know, that's probably a good idea because you don't want to use your personal number for business texting. Because we talk to plenty of people who regret texting clients or customers from their personal phones because it's just like it crosses the line between personal and professional. With Textline, you can go offline. You can disconnect from your work SMS number. You can also send replies really easily. You know, you can create custom responses, set up bots to respond to SMS commands. So for example, if a customer asks you, like, what is your location to your business, Textline can automatically send back an address and a link to Google Maps. So it's a pretty cool service, and we have a special offer for Cast of Kings listeners. All you got to do is go to textline.com/castofkings. And typically, textline.com comes with a 30-day free trial. Businesses or organizations can use Textline free for a month with no commitment required. But if you sign up after visiting textline.com/castofkings, your promo code gets you an additional 30 free days to be applied automatically. So just go to textline.com/castofkings. And wow, Joanna, we've had some pretty cool sponsors this year, huh?
We have.
I think we've been very grateful for the people who have cool products and also support the show. So thanks so much to people like Textline for backing us. And it is a super cool service if you have a business or you're an organization and you want people to be able to text you. And in fact, we have some texts that we ask people for. And we gave out our number and we said, hey, text us your reaction. if you want, to this week's episode. So we got a few reactions, and my favorite one is this person just sent two texts. The first one was when the show began. They said, "Man, what the hell is going on House Tyrell over there?" And then 45 minutes later, wow. those are the two texts.
That's the roller coaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam in St. Paul texted in, "Frey pie. I know the face stuff doesn't make sense, but I don't care if I get Frey pie." So we'll talk about that shortly. But
sure will.
Yeah. And yeah, actually, this other Stuart from Baltimore texted in that the Walder Frey death scene justified the entire trip to Braavos for Arya. If we didn't have that lengthy excursion, one wouldn't believe that Arya could turn Frey's sons into meat pie and then get so close to Frey. But the build-up sold that plot twist in much the same way that long, gratuitous torture of Theon allowed us to believe that he became Reek. So that's Stuart from Baltimore texting in. So again, thanks for all your texts this season. And if you want to sign up for a free 60-day trial, actually, 60 days, textline.com/castofkings. So why don't we start with those texts just now, Joanna? So we had a few texts from people who were talking about what happens at the Riverlands. Jaime and Bronn and the Freys, they're all toasting their victory. And one of the servers is giving Jaime some very amorous looks. She's studying Jaime. And then Jaime and Walder have a chat about both being Kingslayers, and you were saying Jaime reacted really well and actually told off Walder Frey and said, like, I need to come fix your problems for you. What good are you to us? Which I thought was a pretty risky move. It's not a good idea to anger Walder Frey. We've seen he does not take kindly to that. Are we completely off book at this point, Joanna? Did you have any idea what was going on here?
You're a great conqueror. Go on, mock me, boy. You think I mind? The Tullys mocked me for years. The Starks mocked me. Where are they now? You talk about war as if you're an expert, but the one battle I remember you fighting, you were captured by Robb Stark, the young wolf. It doesn't matter. Here we are now. Two Kingslayers. We know what it's like to have them grovel to our faces and snigger behind our backs. We don't mind, do we? Fear is a marvelous thing.
They don't fear the Freys, though.
They fear the Lannisters. We gave you the Riverlands to hold the Riverlands. If we have to ride north and take them back for you every time you lose them, why do we need you?
The Frey pie stuff is from the books.
Oh, interesting.
So I was pretty sure Frey pie was coming, but the Jaime Frey stuff isn't. I really did think that was Nicolai Coster-Waldau's, like, best performance in seasons, because Miguel Sapochnik just, like, sat the camera right up in his face. And there's a profile shot where you can see Walder's talking about how they're both Kingslayers, and he's chortling, and Jaime's whole face is quivering because he's so angry and upset. And yeah, so the fact that he maybe impolitically lashed out, I completely understand. Because it's a nasty, nasty mirror that he doesn't want to look in. I thought it was really well done, and good motivation for him to get out of there in time to not get murdered by Arya.
Yeah.
Sometimes people escape from a situation just in the nick of time, and it's unbelievable, but this, like, really felt rooted in character. And David Bradley, who plays Walder Frey, is amazing. And so this interaction between the two of them, which is so rooted in character and dialogue, felt really believable to me that Jaime would grab Bronn and be like, "We're out!" And so then the stage would be set for... I think what Weiss and Benioff said when they were talking to Deadline was that Arya was eyeing him as sort of like a, can I get the Freys and a Lannister at the same time? That would be awesome. Right. Like, she came in there for Walder Frey, but she was like, well, bonus Jaime Lannister wouldn't hurt. So yeah, it was a good thing that he got out of there.
So then Arya kills Walder Frey in rather brutal fashion after feeding him his sons.
Yeah.
In South Park-like fashion. Have you seen that episode of South Park?
No, my illusion was Shakespeare and Greek mythology, but South Park works too.
Same thing. Is it? What are you thinking of? What, Titus Andronicus? Is that the one?
Yeah, there's Titus Andronicus, and there's also like Tantalus in Greek mythology. Like this.
Let me just say, I knew the reference, Joanna. Okay, but I choose to refer to South Park.
Okay.
anyway, the horrifying prospect of eating your children and then getting slaughtered slowly to death by Arya. Do you feel, as Stuart from Baltimore texting us through text line did, that this payoff completely justified the whole Arya storyline this season?
No, but it was pretty great. There's still – okay, here's what I'll say. There's still some weird mumbo jumbo going on with face swapping in the House of Black and White that you can spend all day explaining to me. Like, did Arya pocket some faces when she left? Did she murder someone in Westeros to put that face on? Like, the show has decided not to make clear the process of being a faceless man. And I'm at peace with it.
Yeah, there are people.
Like,
so
you
after,
know what? Like, people are upset, and I understand why. Because really, if you want to look at it logically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But it was a pretty great reveal. And also, face swapping, you're not supposed to change your body form. And the serving wench was a lot taller and more developed than Maisie Williams. But whatever. It was a cool moment. And in the books, it's someone else. It's Wyman Manderly who bakes Freys into pies. I thought it was cool that they gave that to Arya. It was much more narratively satisfying than, like, let's introduce this random northern lord and he's going to bake some Freys into pies. Like, let's give it to Arya instead. And I was pretty sure that they were going to do Frey pie from, like, way back in season three, because in season three, Bran tells the story of the Rat King, who's this disgruntled chef who kills a prince and bakes him into a pie, serves it to a king. And in the books, that is tied to the Frey pie thing. So when the show went ahead and did the Rat King thing back in season three, I was like, why would they do that and not eventually give us Frey pie? Like, there's no reason to leave that breadcrumb trail if it's not leading to Frey pie. So I was hoping – I've been hoping for this for a long time, and I was really satisfied with how it happened.
Yeah, there were a lot of people preemptively emailing us this week saying, like, hey, before you complain about the Arya storing faces thing in her pocket or whatever, just remember that Jaqen H'ghar was also morphing faces in, like, season two, and he didn't have access to the big face wall back then, so...
But I never got the sense that Arya, like, became a faceless man master. Like, we never saw, like, and, like, I really didn't want to go down this track, but, like, if she had already mastered that skill, why wouldn't she have used it back in Braavos when she was trying to hide from the Waif?
Mm.
Like, if she already knew how to swap faces with no probs, like, why was she wandering around with her own face on?
It's almost like the plot line is completely inconsistent and makes no sense. But
it makes no sense in no one, but is satisfying in this episode, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I guess. A lot of people, including Stuart from Baltimore, who texted us, said, oh my gosh, the buildup was totally worth it. And my reaction is, this is pretty much exactly where she was at the end of last season, right? I mean, didn't she kill Meryn Trant last season?
Yeah.
It's a very similar scene, except maybe she's a bit better and more heartless at it. I will say the look on her face when she's draining the blood out of Walder Frey's throat is chilling to behold. But she was often dudes with faces already last season. So why did we go through that whole Braavos faceless man storyline with the Waif this season? I still have no idea. Yeah.
My only hope is that when the White Walkers invade and the Long Night comes, it's like really dark. And Arya is going to need to be able to fight blind. It's going to be very important. Then I will feel like it paid off. But no, I mean, the Arya stuff this year wasn't great. I think
it was pretty.
We can all say that. But this was a great scene for her. And hopefully, Benioff said in the post-episode interview that we should be worried for Arya. We should be worried when she slits this guy's throat and has this sort of beatific look on her face about it.
I was already worried about her with the whole Meryn Trant situation.
You've been worried about her since she stabbed, you know, Polliver in the throat. Like, you've been worried about Arya for a long time. I'm not saying this is new information. I'm just saying, like, I said a similar thing last week when Sansa walks away from Ramsay with a little smile on her face. Like, I don't think that we should see these actions from the Starks as holy fuck yeah, you go girl moments. Like, we should be a little bit worried about the decay of their souls when they do these things, even though it's like righteous vengeance.
Sure. No. My beef is not with the decay of their souls. My beef is just that, how has this character advanced this season at all? You know, there's some characters who have advanced a great deal. Tyrion has been humbled. Dany has amassed more forces. Theon has gone through so much in the last few years, you know. So the Arya storyline has been a huge disappointment for me. All right, what else goes on? Let's talk about Old Town. Sam and Gilly arrive at the Citadel. They check into the library, and that is pretty much it, right? Like,
would you say bang for buck, like a payoff per minute on screen, that by that metric, John Bradley, who plays Sam, is the MVP of the season? He had two scenes or two setups, right? The dinner situation with his father, which I thought was great. And then some like fun comic relief in the Citadel, which I thought he sold really, really well. I loved his scene, the library, his like expression seeing all those books was pretty great. And this is an example of we don't have much to do with these characters this season. We need to get them from point A to point B, but we don't have a lot of time to spend with them. But we don't want you to forget about them. So we're going to give you two scenes with them. And I feel like they don't think that they could do that with Maisie Williams, but maybe we all would have been better off if Maisie had like one scene in Braavos and one scene in Westeros.
We wouldn't have gotten that amazing play, Joanna.
That's true, which was so good.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
So good.
I say that completely serious. It might sound like I'm being sarcastic, but I'm not. So we still don't know what's going to happen with the sword Sam took, but I assume that's going to come into play at some point.
Did you see how hilariously, like, clumsily he wrapped that thing?
Yeah, it is very obviously a sword. It is not, could not be anything else.
And I don't know where he stashed it. Like, when they walked into the library, it was nowhere to be seen. I guess they must have lockers in the library. But, Sam has Heartsbane, a Valyrian steel sword, and he's got access to all these books. And I'm hoping that he's going to dig up some info that's going to help in the great war to come. I expect for Sam.
I agree that Sam's performance here is great. The part when he's, like, running his fingers along the side of the books I thought was great. Mm-hmm. The library, the actual reveal of the library, I thought was a little bit too CGE for me, like CG-esque. I could kind of see, there's some scenes when I'm not even thinking about the fact that what I'm looking at is impossible and it is CG. But this was not one of those scenes. However, I did really love the fact that, from what I recall, you see these gigantic like astrolabs hanging the air, and that is the same device that is used in the opening credits of the show.
Yeah, it even has the same like engravings in the opening credits. Yeah, I thought that was a really cool touch.
So cool. This whole time I've been like, what is that thing anyway? And now we know it's these things that hang in the sky from the Citadel Library. So good stuff there. And yeah, I think your prediction about Sam, as usual, Joanna, I think your prediction in this case is correct.
Well, I mean, not like I invented the wheel. That's probably what, you know, everyone would expect Sam to do. The big subversion would be if Sam's like, so I went to the library, didn't find anything. Bought a bag. So then we can complain about a waste of time. But right now, I mean, I hope for more wacky antics in the library of the Citadel. I thought John Bradley was so good in that scene. I don't know what Gilly's going to do. Also, I mentioned this on Vanity Fair, but like, if you rewatch this episode and you want to play a drinking game, drink every time it looks like Hannah Murray, the actress playing Gilly, cannot hold that baby. She keeps like hoisting it back up because it's way too big and heavy for her. And so drink every time she shifts that baby on her hips, and you'll be nice and toasty for the finale. So
nice. All right, we also got a one scene location. Go ahead.
Well, we should say when they arrive at the Citadel, we see all the white ravens going out, which is the herald that winter has come.
Right.
Right. So.
And winter in this universe lasts for many years, right?
Yeah, it's a long time, but they can be longer and it's variable. We saw a white raven back in season 2, I think it was, and that signaled the end of summer. So presumably since season 2 and now it's been autumn. And now the White Ravens are out because winter is officially come.
Yeah, nice. We got another location that had just one scene this episode, and that was Dorne, our favorite place. Lady Olenna was great here. She's basically acting as an audience surrogate.
Yes.
Telling off all the sand snakes and, you know, calling them stupid. And it's incredibly cathartic. And Varys shows up. And so they're apparently Varys is apparently roping in the Tyrells and the Dornish into the Dany fleet. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So
and the Tyrells. Yeah, I guess you shouldn't call them Martells because all the Martells are dead. But yeah, the Tyrells and the Sand Snakes, who I guess run Dor now with no argument.
That is one of the big issues with this episode, I would say, is the idea of succession. That succession has gone a certain way for theoretically many generations in this world. And that, hey, we can just throw that all out because of a series of crazy developments. That the Sand Snakes are running Dorne, and Cersei can be in charge of King's Landing, and Jon Snow can be King of the North, apparently. So just throw all that to the wind. What do you think? Did that bother you at all?
It bothers me in Dorne more than it does in
in the other places.
Because
at least
Landing.
You could understand why that might happen.
I mean, in King's Landing it happened because she blew up everyone else, right? She blew up her competition. I think technically Jaime is in front of her. Now that he's no longer in the Kingsguard, he's in front of her in the line of succession. But, you know, she's a terrorist and a usurper. So Cersei's on the throne. Jon, I mean, Lyanna Mormont gave a very convincing speech. So I guess we can kind of see how that happened. But in Dorne, I mean, like I said, we don't want to spend more time in Dorne understanding why everyone was okay with the assassination of House Martell, which has ruled Dorne for centuries and centuries and centuries. But, you know, apparently they are. And the Sand Snakes are in charge now. So, you know.
Anything else you want to say about this Dorne plot? Or we're done, right?
I mean, presumably we'll see them as part of... Well, we'll get to Daenerys' final shot later, right?
Yes.
Okay.
For sure.
Then that's all I have to say, yeah. Great Olenna sass, as you say, audience proxy, putting the Sand Snakes in their place. Fantastic.
So do you remember that Kickstarter project, Fixing Dorne, which was a project where they tried to raise $20 million to shoot an alternate version of Dorne?
Yeah.
Any guesses as to whether or not it succeeded, Joanna?
I would guess it did not succeed.
That is correct. They did not raise the $20 million necessary, unfortunately.
How shy of 20 million are they?
They were a little bit over 19 million shy of the 20 million, unfortunately. They raised $32,922. So the optimal Dorne realization will have to live on in our imagination.
I was going to say one other thing, which is, like, you know how great Olenna was with the Sand Snakes? Now imagine if we had gotten an Olenna scene with Ollie and, like, she had been able to speak her mind about what the audience really thinks about Ollie. Well, how would that have gone?
I mean, I think she would have lavished him with praise for his incredibly reasonable reaction to everything that happened.
Oh, yes.
So
she would have been like, you are the prince that is promised. Is that what you're saying?
you know, Joanna, you're really beating a dead Ollie in this situation, which I'm going to try to let it bounce off me, you know? I'm gonna try not to be like Ollie and not hold it against you, you know, for a really long time. Anyway.
Yeah, please don't stab. Just please don't lure me somewhere the promise of my uncle and then stab me.
Yeah, I'll work on that. So what else happens in this episode? I think just two more, three more major plots. So we're already an hour into this podcast. We have three major plots to discuss still. Let's get to it. What happens in Meereen? Dany dumps Dario and, you know, leaves him there to kind of rule Meereen. And then she has this conversation with Tyrion about what her next steps are and kind of like her anxiety about what she has to do. What did you think of this scene, Joanna? A lot of people thought it was really effective.
You're in the great game now. And the great game is terrifying. The only people who aren't afraid of failure are madmen like your father.
Do you know what frightens me? I said farewell to a man who loves me. A man I thought I cared for. And I felt nothing. Just impatient to get on with it.
He wasn't the first to love you. And he won't be the last.
Well, you have completely failed to console me.
For what it's worth, I've been a cynic for as long as I can remember. Everyone's always asking me to believe in things. Family, gods, kings, myself. It was often tempting until I saw where belief got people. So I said no thank you to belief. And yet, here I am. I believe in you. It's embarrassing, really. I'd swear you're my sword, but I don't actually own a sword.
It's your counsel I need.
It's yours. Now and always.
Yeah, I thought this was some of Dinglish's best work. I'm kind of glad that we won't have to deal with Dario anymore. And Emilia Clarke, I think, is at her best when she's acting opposite Peter Dinklage. So I thought it was really impressive, really touching that she made him Hand of the Queen and his sort of face when she does. This was an interesting callback to season five, I think. Yeah, so season five, when Jorah is talking to Tyrion and Jorah's like, I've been a cynic my whole life. And then I saw, like you, and then I saw Daenerys like walk into the flame and all this stuff. And I was transformed and I was a believer, basically. And Tyrion says basically the same thing. I've been a cynic my whole life, but I believe in you. And so, you know, it's sort of this recurring theme of Daenerys as a godlike figure and her ability to inspire, you know, people who didn't think they would ever have something to rally around. I don't always feel like Daenerys, the character, is worth that, but it is an interesting model of power, the like the God King sort of thing. So I think it's interesting.
I did find the dumping of Dario to be really satisfying, especially after he had mistreated Jorah the whole season. You know, he was such a dick to Jorah.
He was such a dick. And didn't he say something nasty about, like, you'll never get to ride the dragon?
Right.
Like, bye, Dario.
To see him then humble himself and still get rejected, it's very satisfying.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I really like that. And yeah, very touching scene when she pins that pin onto Tyrion and he gives her that look of gratitude. And he's it's a powerful moment. So.
Someone pointed out to me that the Hand of the King pin in King's Landing is Lannister gold, but Daenerys's is silver, or pewter at least. Like, it's, you know, it's different. I don't know. That is a fun little detail. Because Qyburn, we see that later that Cersei has made Qyburn her hand. So he's wearing the golden sort of Hand of the King pin, but Tyrion's got the Daenerys pin. I'm so happy to see him wear that, because that was my that's peak Tyrion to me. Tyrion is Hand of the King / Queen. That is him at his in his position to be his best. So I'm excited. I'm glad to put Meereen in the rear view and see what's coming next.
Let's talk about what happens north of the Wall. It's been a few episodes since we've touched base with Bran and Meera. Benjen apparently walks them to somewhere close to the Wall, right? Is that what the sense is?
Yeah. I rewatched the episode a couple times and I just never quite paid attention, because like, he's looking, there's something beyond the tree line where he's
right.
looking. So maybe he can see the Wall like Sarah Palin can see Alaska from her house. Like, he can see the Wall from where they are in the tree line. And I mean, I don't know why he wouldn't get them closer.
Well, they explain that.
No, I know why he can't go south of the Wall.
Right.
But I don't know why, like, he can get them even like a little, like he can't bring them. I mean, he can't bring them to the gate. Like,
maybe there's like a proximity thing that like the magic repels him or something.
Maybe.
But yeah, I think is this the first time they explain the magical enchantments in the Wall, or is that did they do that earlier this season?
In the show, it's the first time.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, it's in the books, but yeah, in the show, it's the first time. And basically, like the Wall enchantments are the same as the enchantments on the cave of the Three-Eyed Raven. So dead things cannot go inside that cave until Bran fucked things up, and presumably, dead things can't go south of the Wall, which is why The White Walkers have been sort of prowling for several seasons, but not actually attacking because they can't get past that wall because of the enchantments. So there are some theories, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's just a theory, that Bran, because he's got the Night King's mark on him, is going to fuck up the enchantments by going south of the wall.
Right.
And bring calamity to Westeros. So that might be fun to watch next season.
Yeah, because Bran hasn't, like, pissed enough people off this season yet, I don't think.
My best guess as to why Benjen dropped him where he did is because they needed to be next to the Weirwood Tree. And the Weirwood Tree is a certain distance north of the wall, which we know because Jon
right. And
Sam went there, like, in season one. So we need to be there so that
Bran can want to touch the Weirwood Tree for some reason? Like, what is his motivation there? Is that ever explained? I guess he wants to finish that vision of the Tower of Joy? Like,
wouldn't you?
I mean, I certainly would. So I guess that's reason enough. You know?
Wanted to solve that cliffhanger, bro.
So Joanna Robinson, one of my favorite things about you and about this podcast is, in general, we don't talk about fan theories that have little to no basis in the show. And one of those fan theories is the true parentage of Jon Snow, which is apparently revealed in this week's episode of Game of Thrones. I don't think... In the history of this podcast, in the 59 episodes that we've recorded, plus bonus episodes, I don't think we have ever spoken the terms R plus L equals J, right? I don't think
yes.
It's ever come up.
Correct.
And I think that's awesome because I had no idea what that term meant until this episode. And actually, even after watching the episode, I didn't even really fully understand what it meant.
I want to share one of my favorite moments from this fall, and you and I have talked about this off air, is that we were doing our season one rewatch. It came up just because John talks about like being a motherless bastard and so sad, and Robert brings up his mom and stuff like that to Ned, and so I was like, well, have you never wondered who John's mom is? And you're like, nope. No, like just blissfully unaware. And I'm just sitting here being like, oh, Dave's going to have such a good time when this comes out. So, yeah, here we go.
Yeah. So a lot of people had their minds blown by this fact because they were like, I can't understand how you avoided this for so long. I mean, I had seen the R plus L equals J, but I had never really until I would say late this season, like the latter half of this season, I hadn't really considered how it might tie into John's parentage. And the reason I did start thinking about it is because the volume of that theory started to increase, and also because of all these flashback episodes and the previously on Game of Thrones elements, that would kind of hint at this going on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there was definitely a lot more fan chatter about it this season. So I kind of started to get a little more spoiled this season. But anyway... Ned Stark gets the top of the Tower of Joy in the flashback, and when he got there, did you already know what was there when he got there? Like, did you already have a sense of what that would be?
Yeah, it's in the books. Well, yeah.
Oh, really? I thought the Tower of Joy stuff wasn't explicitly in the books, but...
Well, you have Ned dreaming about it's all, like, in a dream, and it's pretty clear from the dream... that it's Lyanna dying and Jon Snow's there and she says, promise me, Ned. And, that's all like there in the text if you know to look for it.
Can I just go on a little rant here, Joanna Robinson? And that is people who watch movies or TV shows where they purposefully mute the audio and then these people go out and try to read scripts or read lips or figure out a way to find out what it is that was said. And I can guarantee you that 99% of the time when you do that, what you will find will disappoint you. Like there's just – whatever you can make up is probably far more interesting. I think the best example of this is the end of Lost in Translation when, spoiler alert, Bill Murray whispers some words into Scarlett Johansson's ear. No one knows what it is. And so you just have to kind of – figure it out yourself. And then later on, people figured, like, they actually used, like, technology to determine what it was. And it's a total letdown, guys. Like, I mean, it just, I don't understand. If the creators of the show are purposely leaving it out, there's probably a reason for that. So there goes my mini rant. What do you think of that, Joanna? And I say that knowing that you might be one of those people that...
No, I'm not. I sort of feel like the lip reading thing, because yeah, we get, in this scene, we get Lyanna saying like, Robert would kill him if he found out, something like that. You know, promise me, Ned, promise me, all of that. But there is a part where she's whispering, I think, and she says like, his name is, and then you can't, and then it's inaudible. So then the question is like, what's Jon Snow's real name? And like, I find that I don't care what his real name is. Like, right. I don't think it's like that informative. I don't think there's any name that's going to be like, whoa, you know? So, what she says, I am assuming will either be revealed or not revealed. And I'm not too fussed about it. Because I feel like I have the information that I need, which is that, you know, Jon Snow is the product of a sexual relationship between Lyanna Stark and Rhaegar Targaryen.
Right.
And that Ned Stark, knowing that Robert Baratheon would kill Jon because he's a Targaryen, and Robert Baratheon was single-minded about killing all the Targaryens, lied to everyone, including Catelyn, for years to protect Jon. And to keep his promise to his sister.
Right. So. And that, you know, adds so much heartbreak and poignancy to the events of season one, you know, that
yeah.
if Catelyn had just understood the, lineage of Jon Snow, that she would not have treated him so terribly, you know, and maybe Sansa as well. And anyone else who treated Jon badly, like they probably wouldn't have treated him as badly if they knew, you know?
The explanation is there that like Ned couldn't tell anyone for fear of Robert's vengeance and wrath. But I honestly think the reason that Ned never told Catelyn is a technical one, which is that Catelyn is a point of view character in the books. And so George R. R. Martin couldn't have her knowing about Jon Snow's lineage if he wanted to keep it this big secret.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to have Catelyn believe that Jon was a bastard so that when you were in her chapters, you got confirmation that Jon Snow was a bastard. And it was only Ned who knew. So
interesting. But it also makes sense from a plot perspective that he'd want to keep it a secret. So
I've argued with people a lot about this over the years. I can understand Ned keeping it a secret from Catelyn because they were newlyweds. I can understand him keeping it from her for like the first couple years. But when he saw how shittily she was treating Jon, and they just very much seemed like a couple that trusted each other.
Yeah.
So when he saw that Catelyn was miserable and Jon was miserable, I feel like he would have told Catelyn eventually, and that he could have trusted her with that secret. And I really feel like the only reason that they had him live a lie that made his nephew and his wife miserable was so that to preserve the storytelling structure of the books.
We can agree to disagree on this one, especially because they could have just changed that for the show if they wanted to.
No, they couldn't change it for the show. Catelyn's hatred of Jon Snow is so formative to like who he is and his like inferiority complex and like how much he feels like he needs to prove himself and all of this his whole life. Like it's so formative for his character that there's no way they could just adjust that for the show.
All right. Well, agree to disagree, but that's cool. It's cool. Like I think your point of view is very well backed. So and as usual. So, So. This is something that fans have been looking for confirmation for a long time. And in fact, my urban legend has it that this is the question that helped Benioff and Weiss get the series, right? I assume you're aware of the story?
Yes, I am aware of the story.
That George R. R. Martin had spoken with them for hours and then at one point had asked the question, who is Jon Snow's mother? And they had answered the question correctly. And so that's kind of what that was like George R. R. Martin's test as to whether or not they would be worthy of the series.
And so I believe they owe Reddit a thank you letter. Like, I'm very sure that they got that from the internet. I mean, whatever. Maybe they didn't. But I'm pretty sure that they got that from like a Wiki of Ice and Fire or something like that. So, you know.
I thought that the way they did it in the show was pretty artful. You know, that they do mute some of the audio and you hear just enough to find out. And then there is a cut very abrupt from the baby's face to John. But they don't say the baby's name is John Snow. You know, like there's no big, dumb reveal. It's kind of artful and beautiful, I thought. What did you think?
Yeah, there's a great cut back in, I think it's season four, when Sam and Maester Aemon are talking in Castle Black, and Maester Aemon says something about, like, it's a terrible thing to be a Targaryen alone in the world. And then Jon walks in the door, and the camera cuts to him. Like, they've been doing these little cuts throughout the series. And there's a great video that I posted on Vanity Fair done by, oh God, I think his name is Robbie McDee, is the YouTube user who made this amazing, amazing video that's all the show stuff, not book stuff, but just show stuff that has laid this breadcrumb trail. Like, that all these little hints were there all along if you knew what to look for. Hmm. So it's really cool.
But what about the fact that Jon burns his hand in, I think it's season one or two?
Targaryens are not immune to fire.
I know. I'm kind of just giving you a hard time.
You're just trying to break me.
I'm just trying to get a rise out of you.
Mission accomplished.
But what's crazy about this development is that, like, Jon has a very legitimate claim to the throne. So that is kind of established in this Tower of Joy scene. Then we go ahead.
I don't know that that's true. He's a bastard. I mean, there's no...
Oh, right.
There's no fact one way or another. There's no knowing one way or another whether or not... Okay, here's a complicated backstory, right? Rhaegar was married to Ilya Martell, right? He was already married when he ran off with Lyanna. We're presuming that the running off together was mutual. There's a lot of textual evidence for that, that they sort of ran off because they were in love. And the Targaryens did occasionally take multiple wives, so it's possible that they got married, in which case I'm not 100% sure what Jon's legitimacy would be. But more likely, they did not get married. They just ran off, and Jon's still a bastard. He's just a bastard of different lineage. So I don't think he has a real claim to the throne at all.
Gotcha. So I guess then, what are the implications of the fact that he's a Targaryen and Stark child, you know, for the show? Like,
destiny.
Yeah. Just that
the book's called A Song of Ice and Fire, ice being Stark, fire being Targaryen, and sort of like his whole, they're part of the Azor Ahai prophecy, which is something that Melisandre keeps banging on about, right? Is that the prince is promised to be born under a bleeding star. And there's this really cool shot in the Tower of Joy scene where Ned puts Arthur Dayne's sword, which is a Sword of the Morning, which has a star on the top, it has a sun, on, like, right next to the blood that's sort of seeping down Lyanna's bed. So it's like a bleeding star, sort of all these portents of his destiny and his connection to Daenerys. And there's theories about, Targaryens have the ability to control dragons to a certain degree, plus or minus. And so Jon might be able to control a dragon when those dragons make their way to Westeros. So those are some thoughts. Those are not spoilers. Those are just thoughts.
those are just random thoughts.
I mean, there are ways in which Jon could be legitimized as a bastard. It's all possible. I mean, as a bastard, he became King of the North. So anything is possible in the great American dream that is Westeros. But I don't think technically he has a claim to the throne right now.
Gotcha. So we cut to Winterfell with Jon Snow there with his men. But there were a couple of other scenes at Winterfell that happened before this point. Firstly, there's a scene where Davos confronts Melisandre, and then Jon, rather than executing her for her horrible acts, merely banishes her, which is kind of an act of mercy. You know, not a bad act of mercy, given that he's alive because of her. How did you think of this scene with Davos and Melisandre played out?
Well, first of all, Liam Cunningham, who plays Davos, was fucking incredible in this scene. He was amazing. And so was Chris Van Houten, who plays Melisandre. I thought this was fantastic scene. I think it such a good scene that should have happened like 3 episodes into the season.
Right.
You know, because Davos like half asks her about Shireen like a couple times this season. And Melisandre has not done anything useful since she brought Jon back. So if she had been banished in like episode 4, that would have been the same sum total. I don't know why they kept her around. That being said, it was interesting to see Jon reject the thing that Stannis was seduced by, this promise of power and help. But as some people pointed out to me, you know, Melisandre's like, you know the great war is to come. You know I can help you in that war. And like some people were like, why didn't he point out that she was of no help during the Battle of the Bastards? Like she did literally nothing to help him in that particular battle. But anyway, he sends her away. It's merciful, but honorable and a great news for the kind of leader that we want John to be, I think.
Joanna, one of the big beefs we had with last week's episode was the idea that Sansa would withhold this crucial information from Jon Snow. The Knights of the Vale were going to join her in battle. And we received dozens of emails with justifications for why Sansa might do this. Hey, she's positioning herself for greatness. She is. The show is supposed to make her look like a heartless military mind, you know? And I just feel like none of that is backed up by what happens in the show. I mean, it just feels like very clumsy writing with regards to the whole Sansa bring the knights, you know.
Yeah, I mean, she apologized.
She apologizes. And
admits that she was wrong.
And John's just like, okay, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Oh, I wasn't even thinking about the fact that thousands of my men died unnecessarily, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty disappointing way for that to conclude. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad we're past it. I'm glad we're on the other side of it. But yeah, it really does feel to me like the whole reason for it last week was so that they could have the narrative surprise of the Knights of the Vale showing up and not rooted in any sort of character motivation that makes sense to me.
Yeah, agreed.
I still feel that way. But they did have like a nice moment on top of the parapet of Winterfell where they were talking about, you know, Ned and the House Words and they were smiling and you're like, oh, and like John so rarely has friends like since Sam left particularly and Ed, I guess, but like and Tormund. Okay, he's got some friends, but like he's so he's like so much more smiley around Sansa than other people and then it just breaks your heart when you see Littlefinger just continuing to pour poison into Sansa's brain and like possibly position her against Jon. That will be pretty devastating.
Well,
to
also
see.
Potentially be like romantically interested in her, which is
is
kind of gross given that he wanted to bone her mom as well.
It's right? So creepy. It's so creepy. And what's great is that like when he tried that move on her at the Eyrie, she just let him kiss her and it was so gross. And in this one, she's like, yeah, not so much.
Yeah.
No, you don't get to kiss me right now because it's gross. Yeah. But I did like I will say that that's like some of the best little fingering I've ever seen is like him leaning against the wall in the Winterfell Hall and just sort of smirking and side eyeing the whole and you can see him doing calculus in his brain of like,
yeah,
which way is the room going to go? How is the power shifting? What is going to be my move in response to that? Like it was really good silent acting from.
He is not happy. He is not happy. So, Joanna, before we continue to the final two scenes that we're going to discuss, I think we should mention a bunch of the kind of crazy theories that have been coming up, just so you can shoot them down. One of them is the idea that Sansa's pregnant. We kind of talked about this last week. The one thing I'll just say about this is a lot of people are interpreting, like, when Ramsay Snow says, you know, like, I'll always be a part of you now. Or when Sansa says, like, I can still feel inside me what he did to me, blah, blah, blah. They are interpreting those things literally. And it is completely baffling to me that, how could the show be more clear, they say. And I just like, well, maybe these characters are speaking metaphorically. I just don't get it. Your reaction to the Sansa pregnancy theory, which Liam Cunningham has apparently already debunked at this point, right?
Yes, he has. Praise Davos. Yeah, I think it's nonsense. And I wrote about it last week on Vanity Fair, if you want to feel like the full blaze of my fury about it. But
why is this something that gets you so riled up, I guess, is a question, right?
Yeah. The main origin of it is when the promo photos came out last March. February, this is when it's like really started to pick up steam, is because there were photos of Sophie Turner in her like Winterfell robes with her hands sort of tucked under, and it looked, people were like, she looks really fat, she must be pregnant. So that made me mad.
Which, firstly, you know, go fuck yourself.
Yeah,
right?
Go fuck yourself. So yeah, the origin of this theory makes me so mad. And the fact that then people were scrabbling at the flimsiest clues in order to support this, I think, frankly, like sexist theory, really bothers me. And in my opinion, it this was supposed to be the podcast episode where I was so happy about everything. My opinion is that it diminishes the mental and emotional damage of sexual assault if all you focus on is the literal and, oh, she still feels them inside her. Oh, that must be a baby.
Right.
It's like, no, think about the emotional and psychological damage. Like, that's what the show's trying to show you, not, oh, the most, you know, oh, the only damage of rape is, I mean, I know that's not what people are saying, but like, you know, the pregnancy leap, those are the reasons it really bothers me. Plus, from a logical point of view, she jumped off the walls of Winterfell. That would be a shock to the body. She plunged her body into an icy river. That would be a shock to the body. All of this would make it very hard to carry a pregnancy to term. And then the passage of time. I know that time is very wibbly-wobbly in the show, but, like, you know, it's been a long time she would be showing by now. And if you're still clinging to this and you think she's going to show up next season pregnant, like, that's crap storytelling, right? Like, oh, here's the pregnancy result a season later of a sexual assault that took place back in season 5. Like, it's not happening. Yeah. I hate that theory. Can you tell?
Ranty Joanna is my favorite Joanna.
Okay.
And now I must let you loose on another theory. And I'll say my initial reaction upon watching the Tower of Joy scene was that Robert was the father, because I knew about the term R plus L equals J, and the only R that I knew off the top of my head was Robert. So I was like, oh, it's got to be Robert as the father. And in a after-show Periscope, which thousands of our listeners joined me for, and I'm really grateful for that, they corrected me in brutal fashion and said, no, Dave, you are completely wrong. It's not Robert. But we're still getting some emails saying, is it Robert? Do you think it's possible that it's Robert, Joanna?
No, I'm not angry about this one.
Okay, that's good.
But I will say that, like, R plus L equals J is code that book readers came up with to talk about this. So the R was always Rhaegar,
right?
Because it's the code that, you know, like, the source of the R is Rhaegar. So to slot Robert in there, now, yeah, Robert was engaged to Lyanna, but he never had sex with Lyanna.
Oh,
and yeah. And in the Tower of Joy, Robert... she says Robert would kill him. Like, the reason that Robert would kill the baby is because it's a Targaryen baby, not because it's his baby. Like, why would she be afraid of Robert? Like, he loves Lyanna.
Right.
And so why would she want to shield the identity of her baby from Robert if they had consensual sex and she had a baby from that sex? Like, Robert would be delighted and treat that baby so beautifully. So,
well, I guess when you say it like that, the theory makes no sense. But,
and then some people think it's Aerys, which is who's Rhaegar's father, and that's also baffling to me. But, like, I'm not angry about that. I'm just saying, like, book readers have had, like, 20 years to think about this.
Right. And you've had, like, 6 minutes, you know, so maybe different to book readers.
Well, no, yeah. So I forgive that people having wrong interpretation, but if a book reader is like, no, let me, like, I promise you there's textual evidence for this, like, listen to them. Because I know we're off the books now, but, like, book readers still know some things, right?
So, yeah, no, I would defer to them on this one, so
yeah.
Sure. Anyway, there's a scene.
Yes, we lost, like, 30 live listeners while I was ranting about things. Bye.
I think it's just because we've been going on for almost 90 minutes, Joanna. That's the only reason. So, anyway, this great scene at Winterfell that echoes, I want to say, season 1 or 2, when Robb Stark also gets the King of the North speech, except this time it's Lyanna Mormont who initiates it. And this is when I was, like, this is when I was really, like, very moved by the scene, because just this idea that this girl could inspire these men, could, like, A, call these people out on their bullshit, and B, inspire them in such a way. It's unlike anything I've ever seen on television before, you know? And I just found it incredibly, like, I find those kind of, like, rallying things to be very moving in general, like when all these people rally towards a common cause and come together as a team, like, that's inherently moving. But you add Lyanna Mormont to that equation, and I'm just done, you know? I'm done. So, in a good way, I mean, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm very
yeah.
impressed with it. So, yeah, I mean, what do you think of this scene? I think there's a clear callback to the Robb Stark one, but
yes.
This is Jon, like Jon Snow has been able to amass his power even without having kind of a legitimate claim to the North, as Robb did. So I think that's kind of like especially powerful and shows his ability to gather troops around him. Any thoughts on this?
First of all, we have to just give a shout out to the casting director, Nina Gold, for finding Bella Ramsey, who plays Lyanna Mormont. She's so great.
So good.
So good. MVP. She's fantastic.
Your son was butchered at the Red Wedding, Lord Manderly. But you refused the call. You swore allegiance to House Stark, Lord Glover. But in their hour of greatest need, you refused the call. And you, Lord Kerwin, your father was skinned alive by Ramsay Bolton. Still, you refuse the call. But House Mormont remembers. The North remembers. We know no king, but the king in the North whose name is Stark. I don't care if he's a bastard. Ned Stark's blood runs through his veins. He's my king. From this day until his last day.
My favorite detail of this scene is that, they all rally. They say, like, King of the North, King of the North. Davos gets up. He's like, King of the North. But Tormund and the Wildlings don't say anything because they do not kneel to kings. Like, that's not a thing that they do. So you'll see Tormund just, like, chilling in the background. He's like, I mean, he supports Jon, but he's not going to be, like, King of the... Because he doesn't acknowledge kings. He acknowledged Mance Rayder, the great Kieran Hines, as his king. But, like, he's not acknowledging Jon. So, yeah.
But very moving and inspiring scene. And Lyanna Mormont, I wonder if Bella Ramsey is allowed to watch Game of Thrones. That's a question I had.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. And then we come to it at last, the final scene where they're basically sailing out to sea. Dany's sailing out. And I think a lot of people miss this, that she already had the Martells at her back in addition to the...
It's so weirdly shot. Like, I've watched this scene multiple times, and I watched the behind the scenes episode, like the behind the scenes feature where they went through all the CG that they used to film the scene. And what's weird about the Martell and the Tyrell ships, which have like the Dornish sigil and the Tyrell sigil on the sails, is that they're all very much in the background. I don't know why they wouldn't do just like one establishing shot of these sigils to at least give people a better chance. I mean, there's some like overhead shots, but there's no like real clear shot. You see so many black Targaryen sails, but like just give us a close up of like one green sail and one orange sail, and then people would have been less confused about the fact that she has the Martells and the Tyrells with her already.
Yeah.
Because then when Varys shows up on the desk, people are like, what is happening? And it still doesn't make a ton of sense, to be perfectly honest with you, because in the behind the scenes interview, they said that they're sailing out from Slaver's Bay. So that means that the Dornish and the Martells sailed all the way over to Slaver's Bay and then, you know, got in Beyonce formation to sail all the way back to Westeros. Like that makes zero sense. If they were like halfway between Dorne and King's Landing, but no, the showrunners are like,
they were overdue for a scenic trip, Joanna, and they just wanted to, you know, travel around the world just to come back again, you know?
Yeah.
Plenty. But, you know, the idea is that they're all together, and so that's why Varys is there. A lot of people are thinking, why is Varys just teleporting from place to place? Well, guys, it's because a lot of time has passed between the Daario scene where Dany lets him go and then when they finally all reunite. In the show notes, Joanna, you write, Cersei is fucked after, you know, this scene of her sailing away. And yet, it does seem that way. She's got dragons. She's got Unsullied. She's got Martells. She's got Tyrells. She's got the, like, just basically everyone at her side. The Dothraki Horde as well. Beautiful, haunting final shot.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts on this last shot?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Well, my big question is, how do they make this seem like even remotely a fair fight when they get to Westeros? Like, is it just going to be the biggest tromping in all the world? Is Cersei going to just hurl wildfire at her? Like, what's going to happen? Because Cersei has barely an army left. And, you know, she, like, there are some Lannister men, but a lot of their army was the Tyrell army, and Dany has them now. So, I'm very interested to see how they put any tension into this, or if it's just a complete bulldozing when Daenerys gets there. Yeah. I had hoped that the final shot of this season would be Daenerys landing in Westeros, but I'm okay. I mean, she's on her way, and we're done. Like, my dearest hope, fingers crossed, is that we're done with Essos forever. Bye-bye, Dario. Bye-bye, Braavos. Bye-bye, Meereen. Bye-bye, all of it. And that we just, like, keep tightening the circle in Westeros until we get all the major players in the same place.
I am curious if, you know, Dany has – this isn't the first time Dany's left someplace with a big army at her back, only to end up wandering in the wasteland for many, many episodes. Maybe she's going to encounter some kind of Leviathan in the ocean, and that's going to – ensnare her or something. I don't know. She seems pretty unstoppable, though.
You joke. there might be a Leviathan. But a lot of our live listeners are pointing out that Euron, like, is apparently building 1,000 ships and, you know, wants her dragons and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, maybe Euron will intercept them. But the Iron Islands are all the way the other side of Westeros. I mean, I guess I should stop caring about geography. And, but yeah, it could be, like, if Euron allies with Cersei, that might be but it's still out of whack. And there's no way the Knights of the Vale are going to ally with Cersei because they're part of the Northern contingent now. So we'll see. I'm intrigued to see how all the pieces move. Yeah. But it was a great final shot. I'm so happy that Daenerys is coming to Westeros. Yeah. Finally.
Beautifully done. Great score. So Joanna, I'm thinking, why don't we save our overall thoughts on the season for our bonus episode, which we'll record within the next week or two? And then give our just thoughts on the episode now. What do you think about that?
You don't want all the cartilage in your bones to melt into jelly?
No, I don't. Joanna is referring to the fact that it is incredibly hot in my apartment right now because I have turned off my fan so I can record this podcast. But no, I would like to have my heart not stop beating as a result of recording this show. So, yeah, why don't we save our overall thoughts on the season? Because, Joanna, you've written some pretty awesome stuff, particularly about how this episode ended, that I kind of want to hear more about. But overall, what do you think of this season finale?
Best season finale in Game of Thrones history. Usually they go out with a whimper and they went out with a literal bang. Yeah, and usually you feel it. Usually you feel like, yeah, that they peak in episode 9 and then episode 10 is just table sitting for the next season. And while we did get some table setting, like, it just felt very much an episode in its own right. And I'm so happy that we don't have any huge cliffhangers to be bonkers about in the off season, right? Like, nobody's going to, unless you believe in the conspiracy theory that Marjorie Tyrell is still alive, which you shouldn't, but
yeah, I'm pretty sure you see her get burned alive.
Oh yeah. Like, she gets liquefied. Yeah, yeah, for sure. But, yeah, there's nothing to – I mean, I'm sure we'll all talk and speculate and whatever in the off season, and that's fun. But I did feel – and maybe I'm partially responsible, but I do feel kind of bad, like, the Kit Harington couldn't go anywhere last summer without being mobbed. So hopefully things will be just, like, a little cooler this year about everything.
Yeah. This episode was a masterpiece. I had some beefs with it. Some convenient plot devices were used that didn't really make much sense to me from a character perspective. But overall – what an amazing episode. What an experience to watch it live with everyone. And thanks so much to our listeners this season for joining us for this journey. It's been pretty fun, pretty great, and we really appreciate it. So shall we save the rest for our bonus episode, Joanna?
We shall.
So we will be back within the next week or two with a bonus episode. We are really grateful to all the Kickstarter backers who backed us this season. We missed one name, Yossi Goffman, who wrote in and said we didn't say his name. Yossi, sorry about that. Thanks to everyone who backed us. Thanks to all our sponsors this season. Until next episode, Joanna, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
For the next 2 days, you can find me on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis, and then I'm on vacation. Bye.
She really deserves it. Find me at davechen.me. Find my film, The Primary Instinct, on Hulu and at theprimaryinstinct.com. And join us next week. We'll have a lot more to talk about. We'll have your emails and other reactions to this season on the next episode, the bonus episode of A Cast of Kings.